case for argument is Stive versus United States, Mr. Buchholz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jeffrey Buchholz from the Justice Department for Appellant of the United States. In this Federal Tort Claims Act case involving a claim of battery by a law enforcement officer for the Veterans Affairs Department, the District Court awarded plaintiff Mr. Stive his attorney's fees on the theory that the United States litigated in bad faith, that we defended as a liability in bad faith. This Court's precedents, including Badillo and McCandless, which we cited in our briefs, make clear that attorney's fees can be awarded under the exception to the American rule for bad faith conduct only under a very stringent standard, requiring two things. First, objective impropriety, and second, subjective impropriety. The governing standard makes clear...
I found your use of cases really unsatisfactory. You cite a handful of cases. They're almost all 20 years old or more. And I don't think they state the law. I think the law is that if a suit is frivolous, then the judge has to consider whether to award fees. But he can consider all sorts of things. He doesn't have to find subjective bad faith. If you have someone who's just been, suppose you have some deluded person who files, incessant frivolous lawsuits. At some point, the judge is going to impose sanctions. The person may be perfectly innocent and, think he's been wronged. He's not trying to harass anybody or anything like that. It's not extortion, but the judge gets fed up. And we allow sanctions to be imposed in that such case. In fact, we impose them ourselves in such cases.
Your Honor, you're absolutely...
I think your cases just are not... I mean, you can always find language, in them. There are like 4 million cases in the Westlaw database. You always find judicial language, but I don't think this is an accurate statement of law.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with you to the extent that it is clear that sanctions can be imposed under authorities that do not require subjective bad faith, such as Rule 11, such as some of the federal rules governing discovery, and such as under the Christiansburg standard in civil rights cases, where a defendant can get fees if the plaintiff's suit was frivolous, but without a subjective bad faith element. The Supreme Court has made that clear in Christiansburg. But what we're talking about here is not any of those standards. We're talking about the exception to the American rule for fee shifting. If you read the Supreme Court's decisions in Chambers v. NASCO, in Christiansburg... I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Yeah, what Christiansburg says, the district court may discretion award fees to failing defendant by finding plaintiff's action frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation, even though not brought in subjective bad faith.
My point exactly, Your Honor. Christiansburg is a different standard, a different authority, a different source of a court's ability to award attorney's fees than is at issue here. What's at issue here is the common law exception to the American rule. In Christiansburg, the court expressly distinguished that frivolous
We impose sanctions. Right, under Rule 38, that's your view of an exception?
I think it's important to make clear that there are a number of different statutes and rules and judicially created doctrines that allow the imposition of attorney's fees or other sanctions under a variety of circumstances in a variety of contexts. And those have different standards. Rule 11, for example, does not have a subjective component to it anymore. But as Chambers v. NASCO makes clear in distinguishing the objective standard of Rule 11 from the subjective standard for fee shifting under the court's inherent power, which is what we're talking about in this case, that fee shifting under the court's inherent power does require bad faith. And, Your Honor, in a decision called Miller Brewing...
Well, why do you call it... There is a statutory basis for the award here, isn't there?
Well, the statutory basis is just a waiver of sovereign immunity. 2412C allows the United States to be subjected to attorney's fees
right.
on the same basis as any other litigant. But there is no statute here that provides for attorney's fee liability. The only basis for awarding attorney's fees is the American rule exception for bad faith. The fact that 2412 waives sovereign immunity for that makes the United States liable for bad faith fees to the same extent as any other litigant. But 2412 is not a substantive basis for fee liability here. The only basis for fee liability is, as in Chambers v. NASCO, the inherent power of the court as an exception to the American rule. And Your Honor, I also would disagree. You're certainly correct that there are a number of cases that impose sanctions under a number of different standards, and I suppose it would be possible to pick loose language from different cases, but that's not what we've done here, I submit. This court has squarely held in Badillo that the standard requires objective and subjective impropriety. The court said in Badillo, the court denied, affirmed the denial of fees, saying, quote, there is no element of subjective.
What about the Chambers case, which you did not cite?
Chambers v. NASCO, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Chambers v. NASCO, I think if you read Chambers, it's very clear the court is distinguishing the common law exception to the American rule, which requires bad faith. Bad faith is the formulation the court uses consistently in Chambers v. NASCO, and the court takes great care to distinguish that standard.
Well, it said vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons. Isn't that the formulation in Chambers?
Your Honor, the court in Chambers distinguishes the common law exception to the American rule from Rule 11 and other authorities.
What did it mean? Was it describing the common law rule or a statute when it said vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons?
You're correct, Your Honor, that the court uses those words in describing the common law exception.
Right. Vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons. Well, those are in the alternative. So wantonly apparently is not the synonym for oppressive reasons.
If you read Chambers in its entirety, Your Honor, I submit that...
Well, you didn't cite Chambers, so you didn't really help us with Chambers. I mean, cited on an unrelated point.
I think Your Honor mentions the word wantonly, and that is the word the district court here...
Are you saying a court has no authority under the common law to award sanctions against a person who just files incessant suits that are utterly groundless, that the person is so clueless that he thinks, you know, these are meritorious suits?
I don't at all mean to suggest that, Your Honor. I think Rule 11...
Where would subjective bad faith be in such a case?
Your Honor, Rule 11 might...
Well, forget Rule 11. I'm asking about the common law. Is there no common law? Was there no common law authority before Rule 11 for a judge to say, look, you cannot litigate anymore in my court because you just bring frivolous suits. So I've got to do something to you, enjoin you, fine you, something. You don't think courts could do that before Rule 11?
Courts, I'm sure, could do that. I think
right.
That...
Of course they could do it.
Well, nothing of the sort happened here, Your Honor. There was no warning from
sure,
the court.
Sure, but the question is the standard, whether you're right, that you really have to show that the government people here, the prosecutors, were malicious. You have to show, you know, abusive process or malicious prosecution.
We've been focusing on the subjective bad faith component, Your Honor. If Your Honors would like, I could move to the objective component of the standard.
Sure.
Because it is clear that, first of all, the district court in its order didn't say that fees could be imposed only if, as this court has held, our defense was entirely without color. To the contrary, the district court said all that was necessary for fees under the American rule exception was that our defense had been unreasonable. Unreasonable is not a high enough standard. This court has said in a number of cases that the standard is higher. And really, whatever standard Your Honors decide to apply in this case, there was evidence supporting the United States' defense as to liability. Even the district court recognized
as much.
Well, maybe
as to damages, but as to liability, if the judge looked at the photographs, and even if bad faith is the standard here, and he concluded this guy was beat up, and the argument that he wasn't was pretty frivolous.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think, first of all, you mentioned the photographs. The district court never relied on the photographs. The district court did not say, all you have to do is look at the photographs, and it's clear that there's liability
here.
He
didn't say all you have to do. He said he looked at photographs, didn't he?
the photographs were entered into evidence, the district court may have looked at them. The district court did not say the photographs show that liability was clear. What the district court, Your Honor, distinguished the evidence going to damages from the evidence going to liability, but it was the same evidence. One thing that's important to make clear is...
What about the bruises on his face? I mean, I understand your, you know, your eggshell skull argument about his arm. Maybe they just gave him a little poke, but he had this you know, rotator cuff thing. But he also had, according to the brief anyway, the opponent's brief, he had bruises on his face.
Well, as I said a minute ago, Your Honor, the district court never found that...
A bruise, anyway.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
A bruise.
The district court never found that Mr. Stive, in fact, did have bruises on his face caused by Sergeant Bustle's conduct. And I submit that the photos that are attached to Mr. Stive's brief in this court do not make clear that he did have bruises on his face, nor in any event would those photos be necessarily conclusive evidence. It's not like in this case there was a videotape of the incident that showed, for example, Sergeant Bustle unprovoked punching Mr. Stive in the shoulder while Mr. Stive stood there peaceably, not provoking it in any way. If there had been a videotape or some kind of definitive proof that Sergeant Bustle acted willfully and wantonly to cause injury to Mr. Stive, then he would not have defended this case.
Let me ask you a question about this 25% ceiling. Isn't that the protection of the plaintiff rather than the defendant?
Your Honor, it may be that Congress passed that statute in an effort to protect FTCA plaintiffs. That may well be correct.
Well,
I think that the...
I mean, why should a defendant benefit from the fact that a lawyer is overcharging his client, the opponent? Does that make any sense?
Your Honor, Section 2678, like the rest of the FTCA, are conditions on the United States waiver of sovereign immunity. And as such, if Your Honors were to find that 2678 is ambiguous about whether it applies to an award of fees under the bad faith exception to the American rule, then I would submit that the proper way to interpret it under the Supreme Court's precedents governing sovereign immunity would be to resolve that ambiguity in favor of the sovereign. That would mean the United States would be liable for 25%, but not more, in attorney's fees. But if I may return to the question of attorney's fees in the first place here.
No, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Buchholz. Ms. Mansouri?
May it please the Court, my name is Shanaz Mansouri, and I represent the respondent in this case, Samuel Stive. Your Honor, the first thing that this Court should consider is the fact that the standard of review in this case is highly deferential. In order for this Court to reverse Judge Zagel's determination that the plaintiff was entitled to bad faith attorney's fees, it must find that Judge Zagel's findings of facts were clearly erroneous or that he abused his discretion in awarding attorney's fees. In this case, Judge Zagel clearly laid out numerous findings of facts after observing all of the testimony, reviewing all of the evidence in the case, and taking into consideration both parties' reflections of what occurred on the date of the incident. According to Federal Rule Civil Procedure 52A, findings of fact should not be set aside unless they are clearly erroneous, and due regard should be given to the opportunity of the trial judge to judge the credibility of the witnesses. That is exactly what Judge Zagel did in this case. He reviewed.
Since there's a high standard for liability in this kind of battery case, why couldn't the government have been reasonable in thinking it could, you know, put up a defense, that maybe the serious bruise on his arm could just have been a result of his having this pre-existing condition?
Well, Your Honor, of course there was a high standard here. However, the defendants at no time had any explanation for the bruise either on Mr. Stive's arm or on his face. And contrary to what counsel presented, Judge Zagel did consider all of the physical evidence in this case, including the pictures. He specifically states in his order, quote, the officer's explanation simply does not accord with the observable physical facts of this case. That, to me, clearly states that Judge Zagel looked at the photographs in addition to the medical records. He looked at all of the testimony and determined that a battery, in fact, had occurred and that the defendants could not have presented any reasonable defense that a battery had not occurred. Judge Daigle properly limited the bad faith attorney's fees in this case.
What is this wrist? I never heard this term. What is this wrist lock? They put him in a wrist lock?
Your Honor.
An arm lock. What's a wrist lock?
Your Honor, well, it's actually highly technical, and it's a specific procedure that police officers use during the course of an arrest. At some point, Sergeant Bussell couldn't explain the difference between an arm lock and a wrist lock, so I am in no expert whatsoever in explaining that. However, what it does involve is taking somebody's arm and placing it behind their back, basically to immobilize it for a short period of time so they can cuff it and then cuff the other arm.
But so the wrist lock would involve, or could involve, twisting the arm. Couldn't that have caused this bruising?
Well, Your Honor, a wrist lock probably performed, you know, everybody probably performs it a little differently. But in this case, Sergeant Bussell never stated that he twisted Mr. Stive's arm. He only stated that he grabbed Mr. Stive's one hand, grabbed the other hand, and he placed the handcuffs. He never testified that Mr. Stive resisted it anyway. He never testified that he had to twist his arm and pull it away from his body.
What about bumping him against the police car?
He never stated that he bumped him against
the police car. What did they testify as to the cause of the bruise?
Well, that's interesting, Your Honor, because they never provided an explanation to the cause of the bruise. According to the defendant...
I mean, did they attempt an explanation?
No, Your Honor.
Did they have a theory? Did the government have a theory as to how he might have gotten bruised?
No, Your Honor. And that, I think, again, goes to Judge
Daigle. How soon was the photograph taken after the...
It was taken a few days later by my client's family members at his house. So it was taken immediately after, I think...
Well,
again,
he complained about his arm right away, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
He asked for an emergency.
Well, immediately after leaving the scene, he went from the parking lot where this incident took place to the emergency room of the VA hospital where he had been visiting his son. So within a few minutes, and one of the officers involved in this incident stated that he saw Mr. Stive in the emergency room complaining that his shoulder had been injured. But again, there was no explanation as to why this injury occurred the way that it did and the force that was used. Judge Daigle clearly made the determination that there was bad faith in this case after reviewing the evidence, and short of it being clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion, the fees should be affirmed. Furthermore,
what's the standard that you're advocating for a fee award? So Mr. Buchholz says it has to be, you know, deliberate wrongdoing. They, they were angry at this fellow or something. They were gonna fight this case even though they knew it was frivolous.
Your Honor, I don't believe that it has to be some kind of deliberate. As Judge Daigle stated, that in order to
he relied on the Chambers case.
Yes, Your Honor. And
so is that the only case you have that doesn't involve Rule 12 or Rule 38 or something?
Your Honor, Judge Daigle does rely on the Chambers case, which, as you stated, Your Honor, states that bad faith can be found if the government has acted vexatiously, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons. In this case, Judge Daigle stated that the defendants had acted wantonly in presenting the defense to the battery in the way that they did in this case. And clearly, his decision should not be overturned because that cannot be seen as clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion. The judge relied on the case law that is out there for him to determine bad faith, and he applied it to this case after reviewing all of the evidence. We therefore believe the award of attorney's fees should be affirmed. And furthermore, the 25% cap on this case does not limit the attorney's fees. As Judge Posner stated, the purpose of 2678 is to protect the claimant, not the government. And in this case, if we were allowed individuals to present defenses that were frivolous...
Well, you could think it's both, because by limiting the attorney's fees, the government also limits its exposure should a court award attorney's fees.
Of course, Your Honor. And in certain cases, I think that it would protect the government. However, it should not be a blanket protection for individuals who proceed in bad faith. And in this case specifically, the judge looked at the fees. He reduced the fees as he found appropriate, only limiting them to the liability part of this case, and he awarded those fees. And short of him being clearly erroneous or abusing his discretion.
Well, now, what fees are you going to, would you try to retain? What percentage would you retain?
Your Honor, the judge awarded us fees, I think, near $50,000. I don't understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, it's the question of can you recover more than 25%?
Well, first
of all, you presumably have a contract with Stive.
And yes,
of course,
Your Honor.
So you could get 25% of what? $1,750,000, was it?
No, I wish, Your Honor.
What was it?
The judgment in this case was $87,000. So first,
sorry.
let me back
my
up.
Wires. Another case. I'm thinking. So, so you get 25% of that, or 25%? What is your deal with Stive?
Sure, Your Honor. Let me, before I get to that, however, let me just. I apologize. I meant to address the issue that the defendants in this case never raised this issue of 25% in the lower court. So our first argument in the brief, and I apologize for not presenting this previously, is that the defendants have waived that argument. I mean, in no briefs or motions or any kind of oral statement to the court did they claim that the 25% cap of 2678 applies in this case, and we're therefore arguing that it has waived that argument. However, short of that, what I'm stating is that the 25% limit is on what an attorney can collect or demand in the case. So if the case had been out there and we had received...
If you didn't get attorney's fees in this case...
Thank you, Your Honor.
Then you're limited to 25% of this $89,000.
Yes, and that is exactly our argument, that if it was merely a judgment and attorney's fees were not awarded due to bad faith, that we would only receive 25% regardless of what contract we had with Mr. Stive. However, in this case, because bad faith was found, we are entitled to Judge Zagel's determination as to what the entirety of the fees were. So,
why? On the ground that you probably did extra work because the government was unreasonable and vexatious?
Well, we're exactly, Your Honor.
Is that the rationale?
Basically, what Judge Zagel stated was that this case should not have been defended on the issue of liability, and therefore we should be compensated for our time and the cost that we spent in having to proceed with this case to trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Buchholz, how much time do you have? Another? Well, we'll give you a minute if you'd like to rebut.
Your Honor, when I was up here before, we were focusing on what the governing legal standard is for an award of bad faith fees. I'd like to get away from that for a second. And I'd like to try to make 2 points clear about what the evidence was here, so that really whatever standard Your Honors decide to apply, whether it's the standard in McCandless and in DiDio and in Miller Brewing and other cases of this court, or some looser standard, there were two basic types of evidence here. There was the evidence by the two major participants in the incident, Mr. Stive on the one hand, Sergeant Bustle on the other. And there was medical evidence from both parties.
Is Ms. Mansouri correct that the officers did not offer an explanation for how he hurt his shoulder, his arm?
No, I don't believe that's exactly correct. If by that you mean an explanation medically of how the injuries occurred, well, the officers didn't address that precise issue in medical terms. The medical experts did. But Sergeant Bustle testified that first of all, there's no dispute here that it was proper for Sergeant Bustle to handcuff Mr. Stive. When you handcuff someone, you have to use some amount of force on them. The only dispute here is really whether Sergeant Bustle gave Mr. Stive's arm a little extra shove, whether he yanked it up more than he needed to in handcuffing him. Sergeant Bustle testified that he didn't. The district judge disbelieved parts of Sergeant Bustle's testimony, but found it not to be perjurious. All we did is put him on the stand. The fact that the district judge chose not to credit that part of his testimony doesn't mean that didn't constitute some evidence supporting our defense. The other evidence that the district judge credited as the damages. And in the district judge's oral ruling at the end of trial, which I invite your honors to read, the district judge credited our medical evidence that you can't tell from the injuries that resulted to Mr. Stive's shoulder how much force was used. Both sides' medical experts, ours somewhat clearer than the other side's, but both sides' medical experts testified that because of the pre-existing weakness of Mr. Stive's shoulder, that you can't infer from the fact that a serious injury resulted.
Now you say one of the officers testified that he pulled up his arm or bent his arm, something like that. Had he been deposed?
Yes, Your Honor. Sergeant Bussell.
Had he said that in his deposition?
There was a colloquy at trial about whether Sergeant...
What did he say in his deposition?
Your Honor, I think Sergeant Bussell's deposition was largely consistent, if not entirely consistent, with his trial testimony. There was a colloquy at trial about whether there was an inconsistency in referring to what Sergeant Bussell did as a wrist lock as opposed to an arm lock. I think the district judge made clear at page 123 of the appendix that he thought that the party's dispute about that terminology was overblown and that it was a question of semantics rather than of substance. Apart from that colloquy at trial about whether the technique that Sergeant Bussell used was a wrist lock or an arm lock, Sergeant Bussell's testimony was consistent. And more than Sergeant Bussell's testimony here, the premise of the district court's decision, the line from the district court's decision quoted by Ms. Mansouri, was the injuries are not consistent with denial of a battery given the observable physical evidence, That is incorrect. The evidence here from both sides' medical experts was that you cannot infer from the fact that a serious injury resulted that severe force was used. That means that we have some evidence supporting...
Let me ask you a different question. Do you have any response to the argument that you waived this complaint about the 25%?
I do, Your Honor. As our reply brief makes clear, this court has recently questioned whether the conditions on the United States waiver of sovereign immunity and the FTCA should be considered strictly jurisdictional or something less than that. This court has never actually held that any of those conditions in the FTCA is not jurisdictional. This court always has treated them.
Why should such a trivial thing be considered jurisdictional?
Because the Supreme Court, Your Honor, said in United States v. Motaz, which we cite in our brief, that the terms of the United States waiver of sovereign immunity define the court's jurisdiction. And that means that 2678 is a jurisdictional point that can be raised for the first time on appeal. I regret, Your Honor, that we did not
raise this at
trial.
Well, of course, we're constantly enforcing procedural waivers against the government.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
We constantly enforce procedural waivers against the government.
As you well should, but this is not a procedural waiver in a normal sense. It's a jurisdictional point that unfortunately we did not raise in the precise terms that we're now raising it, but because it's jurisdictional, it can be raised for the first time on appeal. In Scalise, the case that we cited in our briefs, this court said, even though this argument wasn't
I understand. If it's jurisdictional, it's not waivable. Okay, well,
that's
thank
our position,
you.
Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Buchholz. Thank you both, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.